बिहारी जन जसोधा नंदना व्रज जन रंजन जामुना सिराभन्नाचारी जय राधा माधव कुंजा बिहारी कुंजा बिहारी जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज कचरयाश पुरुषोत्त श्री श्रीमार सिवाय श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय ग्रंथराज श्रीमा भागवतम की जय गौर प्रेमानंदी ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द सेवन बॉडीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री श्री गुरु एंड गौरांग ओम अज्ञान तमिलांदस्य ज्ञानंजना शलाकया चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्री गुरुवे नमः श्री चैतन्य मनोभीष्टम् स्थापितां येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वंशाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यरेव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैता गदाधर श्रीवासरी गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय भगवते वासुदेवाय श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 6 चैप्टर 10 वर्स 10 अहो दैन्यम् अहो कष्टम् पराख्याय क्षणभंगुराय यान नोपकुर्यार आस्वार्तायर यानो पकुर्यार आस्वार्तायर मर्त्या स्वक्नाति विग्रहाय अयोष्ण To try. Aho danyam aho kashtam parakyai kshana bhangurai yano pukuryad aswartair martya saknati vigrahai mothers. No? Word to word meaning. Aho, alas, dainyam, a miserable condition. Aho, alas, kashtam, simply tribulation. Parakyai, which after death are eatable by dogs and jackals. Kshana bangurai, perishable at any moment. Yet, because, na, not, upakuriyat, would help. Aswa artai, not meant for self-interest. Martya, a living entity destined to die. Swa, with his wealth, Gnati, relatives and friends, Vigrahai, and his body. Translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation, this body, which is eatable by jackals and dogs after death, does not actually do any good for me, the spirit's soul. It is usable only for a short time and may perish at any moment. The body and its possessions, its riches and relatives must all be engaged for the benefit of others, or else they will become sources of tribulation and misery. Understand? Purport. Similar advice is also given in Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 22, Verse 35. Eta vaj janmasau palyam dehinam ihadehi shru pranayar artarir dhya bhacha kshaya charanam sadha. Quote, it is the duty of every living being to perform welfare activities for the benefit of others with his life, wealth, intelligence, and words. End quote. This is the mission of life. One's own body and the bodies of his friends and relatives, as well as one's own riches and everything else one has, should be engaged for the benefit of others. This is the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as stated in Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, Chapter 9, Verse 41. Bharata bhumite haya manusha janmayar janma sartaka kari kara para upakar. Quote, one who has taken birth as a human being in the land of India, Bharatvarsha, should make his life successful and work for the benefit of all other people. That's the end of the quote. The word upakuryat means para upakar, helping others. Of course, in human society, there are many institutions to help others, but because philanthropists do not know how to help others, their propensity for philanthropy is ineffectual. They do not know the ultimate goal of life, Shreya Acharanam, which is to please the Supreme Lord. If all philanthropic and humanitarian activities were directed toward achieving the ultimate goal of life, to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they would all be perfect. Humanitarian work without Christian consciousness is nothing. Christian must be brought to the center of all our activities, otherwise no activity will have value. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So, Didichi has already established the importance of giving one's body and everything else connected to the body for the benefit of others previously. Anyway, you will lose the body, so might as well give it to others and gain transcendental profit. And he says this is the real religious principle also, that to feel distress when others are feeling distress, and to feel happiness when others are happiness, this is a real religious principle of the human being, really. So here in this verse, he criticizes those who don't give. You follow? So he's already established the importance of giving previously. So in this verse, he's criticizing those who still refuse to give their body for the benefit of others or for the ultimate welfare of themselves even. He's criticizing such persons who remain reluctant to do so on account of their attachment to whatever myopic program of sense gratification that they have. You follow? Sense gratification. But it seems very important, isn't it? Your program of sense gratification seems very important, isn't it? Everyone thinks like that. And so we remain attached to such programs. We refuse to give our body for the benefit of others or for eternal principles. So now in this verse, the Dichi is criticizing such persons. You follow? So in this verse, he's describing, what is his body? So he uses three adjectives to describe the body. The first one is parakyai. Parakyai means his body is destined to be eaten by jackals. Understand? Jackals, dogs, maggots, like this. That's the destiny of your body. Your body is, you love your body very much, isn't it? This is the destiny of it. It's like in many movies you would have that you need to find your true destiny. Here's your destiny. Everyone's destiny is the same. Like one time Prabhupada was told, they said, Prabhupada, this social Darwinism is survival of the fittest. And Prabhupada said, with survival of the fittest, no one is fit to survive. This is destiny. So the first point, this is the adjective used for the body. That it was destined to be eaten by dogs, jackals, and magnets. Isn't it? Time of death. Second adjective used, kshanabhangurai. Kshanabhangurai means that it's destined to drop dead at any moment. You follow? Not only is it destined for being eaten by dogs and jackals, but at any moment you may lose your life. At any moment you may lose your life. I think one time, Prabhupada was being criticized by some scholar as to why he was giving sannyasi to young men. Generally, sannyasi traditionally was given to persons who are 60 plus. And here Prabhupada is giving to men who are like 20 years old and so on. So he's being criticized probably by some Indian man or some scholar. Why are you giving sannyasi to young men? And Prabhupada said, who is, you know, this is for old men. You should give it to old men. So Prabhupada said, who is old? What does it mean to be old? Prabhupada asked this question, what does it mean to be old? Then what type of question is that? Usually we just, because we're conditioned, so we just get bewildered. And so Prabhupada says that one who is just on the verge of death is said to be old. So who in this world cannot be said to be old with that sort of definition? And that way I'm giving them sannyas, because they're already old. So kshanabhangurai means that any moment the body will be finished, at any moment. You're working really hard for your sense gratification. It's all over in just a second. Just like I remember a movie. I give movie examples because I know you relate to them. And also they clarify certain points. There was this one movie, I think it was called The Day After Tomorrow. I was about the second coming of the Ice Age. I saw this before I was a devotee, but something stuck out to me that time. So in the movie, I think the protagonist, a guy and a girl, they're like going for some spelling bee or something. I forget, something like that. Some like major competition. It was like really, really important for them. And they were on the plane and the second Ice Age is beginning to happen. Everything is finishing. Finally, the whole movie is just about them escaping the northern sphere of the world and going down south where the second Ice Age hasn't, you know, made its way. And so they finally are able to do so in the end, and they, you know, kind of like fall in love, and yeah, we did it, we made it to the South Pole. And that was a movie, and then there were some facts at the end of the movie presented about how this could happen and whatever. But I remember seeing this movie and thinking, what happened to their spelling bee? Which was like a really, of course you say, what a dumb thought, they had to save their lives, but it hasn't imprinted my mind even now. I was like, what happened to their spelling? Because it was so important for them. In the beginning, it was like it was consuming their whole existence, their whole mental absorption was focused on the spelling being becoming first place and so on. And here's the second Ice Age coming. They're on the verge of death, and their only happiness became that they were able to survive. And so at the end of the movie, I was like, well, what happened to their spelling bee, which was so important for them and all-consuming and so on? You follow? So similarly, we have life like that. We're having some, again, myopic program of enjoyment, which is very important for us, very dear to us. But kshanabhangurai, at any moment, it can be finished. At any moment, it can be finished. And then what would have been the use of your endeavor? You follow? So that's the second adjective use. The third adjective use is aswartaya. Aswatarya means this body does not give any benefit to the soul. That's how Prabhupada has translated it here. Aswatarya is not actually giving any benefit to the soul. In fact, it's only giving misery. Asana pi kleshada asideha. Rishabde says this body is simply a source of misery. Isn't it? Adhyatmika klesha. Adhyatmika klesha means misery is caused by one's body and mind every day. Isn't it? Every day. Isn't it? Yes, every day. In fact, we say that threefold miseries are there. Adhyatmika klesha. Adhibhautika klesha means misery is caused by other people's bodies and mind. And what is the third one? Adhidaivika klesha. Misery is caused by nature. But in fact, these other two miseries are really situated on the body and mind identification. So really, you can say there's only one klesha. There's only the adhyatmika klesha, the misery is caused by the body and mind. And then according to how the mind is perceiving others or perceiving nature, he's feeling misery. You follow? So really you can say it's just one misery. So this body, aswartaya, doesn't really benefit the soul much. Rather, it causes a lot of misery to the soul. You know every day, isn't it? Every day you're experiencing. Just like yesterday, some issue came up. And your whole mind disturbing you, isn't it? The mind's like taking knives and And externally it looks like this. But the mind is stabbing you with so much tribulation, isn't it? Daily. So the body is not giving much benefit for the soul. It's giving mostly suffering, isn't it? You agree? Yes. Then the fourth one, Martya. Martya means that it is destined to die, finally. Death is coming. And along with that, death of the body, swagnati vigraha. Vigraha, of course, means the body. Swagnati means one's wealth, one's family. Not only is the body destined to just be totally finished at the time of death, but everything connected to that body, which you find near and dear, is also destined for death. So this is what the material body that we value so much, here's its destiny. You know, you go to the sacred sage, I want to know what is my destiny. And he says, this is your destiny. Parakyai will be eaten by dogs and jackals. Shanambangurai, and that too, we don't know when that's going to happen. Any moment it may happen. Aswartai, it is just simply full of misery throughout life, isn't it? It's not that at the time of death you suffer. Throughout life you suffer. Martya swagnati vigrahai, and it's all destined to death. Everything you find near and there will be finished. That is your destiny. You follow? That is your destiny. So this is the body that we find so near and dear. This is what it's destined for. You follow? So then, the question is coming. Yan na upakuryat. Who is that person who will not give this body, which is normally a source of great disturbance and misery, who will not give that for the benefit of others? And implicitly in this statement, and thus gain eternal fame, eternal glory, or ultimately attain the platform of sat, that was kind of mentioned in the previous verse. Who would not give that? The question comes, well, to give it to others is very difficult. This is what makes a person reluctant to give, isn't it? Because if I have to give to others, there is some difficulty involved in doing so. Especially in the case of the Dishi, because he has to actually give up his life. So in giving to others, there is some austerity that has to be undertaken. And generally, conditioned as we are, we don't like austerity. Unless it's forced upon us. Actually, when you voluntarily accept misery, it is called as tapasya. And when it's forced upon you, it's called as tapatraya, threefold miseries. Generally, so we don't want to voluntarily accept any austerity or suffering. And so, especially when it comes to others. Of course, if it comes to our own sense gratification, we'll accept the necessary suffering involved to achieve that. But especially when it comes to others, we're reluctant to take any struggle. Why take struggle? Also, they might not be appreciative, they might not be properly grateful, they won't properly glorify me for the struggle that I've taken. So what's the use? What is the point? We don't want to take any struggle for others, and because of that, it's kind of built into the conditioned psychology, the I, me, mind principle. Because of that, there's a reluctance to give, because I don't want to struggle. I don't want to have to struggle. I don't want to have to take that austerity for the benefit of others. You follow? So here in this verse, he's criticizing such mentality by saying, anyway, you will struggle. Your life is only going to be filled with struggle because this is the destiny of the body. So why not take a struggle which can get you eternal benefit? Since anyway, you will have to struggle. It is not that struggle will be avoided. So we're thinking, I will not struggle for the benefit of others because it's too much. I would rather just focus on my own program. But anyway, you would have to take so much of struggle for that. And also for no gain in the end. In the end, you will gain actually nothing. So who is that person who would not take the struggle for gaining something eternal? Or even in the lower sense, gaining something pious. So he says, a whole dayam, a whole kashtam. How miserable. What a tribulation. So he's criticizing how miserable such thinking is. What a tribulation it is. A whole dayam, a whole kashtam. Yeah, the point is that struggle is unavoidable. So we think, I'll not help others because I have to take struggle. And that will be too much. But anyway, you have to struggle because this is the situation of the body in the material world. The only difference is that when you take a struggle for your own sense gratification, you gain zero. You gain nothing in the end. Whereas if you take the struggle for the benefit of others, particularly in terms of development of the Krishna consciousness, as Prabhupada is highlighting in his purport, then you can gain eternal benefit. So then who is that person who would not take such a struggle for getting eternal benefit? Or how miserable is that person who will simply struggle for nothing in the end? How foolish, how miserable is such a person? Aho dayam ho kashtam. So then Prabhupada's pointing out in the purport that it is our duty to dedicate our life, our wealth, one's intelligence and words for the highest benefit of others. Of course, Prabhupada takes the opportunity to criticize the materialistic forms of helping others in terms of assisting their material body with this sort of destination. That is useless because you don't help them get out of the material world. But he says if you can take these philanthropic activities, which are actually useless, and add Krishna to it, then it can become useful. Otherwise, all these activities, in fact, are just sources of tribulation. That which you are struggling so hard to maintain for your own sense gratification is actually the source of your misery. So that's kind of foolish, that we struggle hard to maintain something that's the source of our misery. Is that not foolish? That's how Prabhupada's translating here, a whole dayam, a whole kashtam. Or else they will become sources of tribulation and misery. That which you struggle hard to maintain for your own purposes is the source of your misery. So you're struggling hard to maintain the source of your misery. How foolish is that? For example, good example, money. That's a good example, isn't it, Michael? A good example. And you struggle hard to get some money, large sum of money is coming, and you struggle hard that I will have that money. I will give it also, but anyway, the mind said, yeah, just I'll allow you to think in this way for the time being. And when the money actually comes, we'll discuss it further. We'll have a further discussion about it. Then you do your own, you're planning, sense gratification plans are going on. And so why? You're taking a struggle, going back and forth, going to the lawyers, this, that, having to tell some lies, also this is going on. I don't think they'll see the video thread. You have to go like this, and taking so much struggle, and thinking, now I'll be happy. And now that same struggle that you thought was going to bring you happiness has become a great source of misery, isn't it? And now a misery that you have to try to fight. It becomes a source of misery, isn't it? Struggling hard to get money and maintain money, but that money becomes a source of misery, isn't it? Similarly, you have family members, children or wife and so on, and you have to feed them, clothe them. I'm talking about non-devotional here, the non-devotional arena. And these children and wife and so on, they simply source of misery, isn't it? Simply source of misery. Children wake you up in the middle of the night and you have to feed them. They never say thank you. In fact, as they get older and they become more recalcitrant, they may even come up to you and say, Dad, I hate you. Mommy, I hate you. Yes, this is how the children are. And so ungrateful. Then they start stealing from you. You open your wallet, two of your credit cards are missing, $50. And you're struggling hard to maintain them, and this is how they reciprocate. And then when you get old and you need their assistance, they throw you in an old age home and see you once a year, for example. So that which you struggle hard to maintain has now become the source of misery. You follow? So many examples you can give. Car, you struggle hard to get a car, maintain the car, clean and so on. But so many parking tickets are coming. You almost hit someone and killed them. So that same car which you value so much has become a source of misery. And this way you can analyze any object in this world which you value and hold near and dear. And if you don't use it for properly, and properly being defined here as for a higher purpose, the highest purpose being the purpose of Krishna consciousness, then that something simply becomes a source of your great misery. And finally, it keeps your mental status, your mental state, so absorbed in it that you get another material body to continue the same struggle in the next life. And this is why this becomes a great source of misery. So who is that foolish person who will not give this for gaining something higher, gaining eternal benefit? The Dishi is criticizing such persons. Are there any questions, comments? Anyone wants to add anything in the discussion? I'm finished. Aswartha, yeah.
Someone has something very valuable but doesn't know what to do with it. Like Prahlad Maharaj says that this human form of life is very, very valuable, arthadam, but people don't know how to use it. I was thinking in terms of examples, you know, one may have a very fancy car, let's say a luxury car, but all they use it for is hauling garbage from one place to another. It has no value. It's not utilized for its purpose. Or there's a story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in the Upadesha Upakhyana about a Brahmana who in the morning would sit with the Shalagram Shila, and everyone would come for worshipping the Shalagram. They would offer some donations and he would throw some flowers, chant some mantras. And in the afternoon when the door was closed, he would take the Shalagram to break betel nut, because betel nut is something you would eat after his lunch. So something so valuable as the Shalagram, he doesn't know how to use it. Yes, he can't understand the value of it. He was appreciating Bhaktisiddhanta's.
Yeah. Actually, you remind me of a verse I wanted to quote in class. Ladwa sudurlabhamidam bahusam bhavante manusham artadamanitam api hadiha. I was wanting to quote this verse. Turnyam yateta nabhatat anumritu yava nishreya shaya vishaya sarvata kalus. What is that? Nishreya shaya vishaya kalusarvatasyat. Yeah. So this verse says that after many, many births, Bahusambhavante, after many, many births, one obtains this rarely obtained human form of life, which is through Durlabham, is rarely obtained. After many, many births, one gets a chance. And although this body is anityam, it is temporary, artadam, it can award one the greatest benefit or the highest benefit. So that dira, one who is sober, turyam yateta napatet, he will immediately endeavor for the highest aim while the body has not dropped down and died. Anumritu yavan. Nishreyashaya means he'll go after the highest benefit. As far as sense gratification is concerned, vishaya kalusarvatasya, sense gratification is available to anyone. The hogs are doing sense gratification. And it's not that your sense gratification is better than this. Someone is thinking, we're a human being, so we have higher class sense gratification. But the hog doesn't appreciate your form of sense gratification. If you offer the hog a lasagna, he will appreciate your lasagna. He likes his food fresh and hot, for sure, but from another part of your body. You understand? He would not appreciate your lasagna. He wants to eat stools. So all the species are enjoying sense gratification according to their bodies, but they don't have the opportunity to gain something higher and eternal. So this human form of life affords one such an opportunity. So if one doesn't use such an opportunity, then how miserable is such a person? Dumb. In a transformed state.
Before I ask my question, just a quick question. What's the reference for this verse?
Do you remember? Canto 9 chapter, I don't know, verse. It's toward the end of the chapter, like the third to last verse.
Okay.
I forget the number.
Thanks. I was really resonating with your point that those things that we struggle hard to maintain end up becoming the sources of our misery. And I was thinking for myself, what are some of the things that I'm struggling hard to maintain that are becoming the sources of misery? And I was thinking one thing is like my opinion of reality, my realizations of what is happening around me. And I find sometimes that I'll draw a certain conclusion and then I'll try to maintain that conclusion and it'll become the cause of great suffering. And I'm not always able to switch my mindset into seeing that actually, although I may be perceiving things this way, perhaps this is not reality. But I just keep on, due to false ego, maintaining this conception, and it becomes very miserable. So how to get away from that?
By Krishna consciousness. What? What is it? How do I get away from being attached to my opinion? And we always joke like that, Maya opinion. So you gotta get out of Maya. How to get out of Maya? Krishna consciousness is the answer. Obviously, it is a challenging thing because according to where you're at in your consciousness, then your perspective of life makes perfect sense. You know, it's just like for a person standing on the first level of a building and looking outside, he has a certain perspective of reality, which is perfectly right from that level of understanding. Then a person standing on the 10th level, he sees a lot more of the city. And so he speaks about something that the person on the first level doesn't see. And so if the person on the 10th level tries to convey his understanding and knowledge to the person on the first level, because it doesn't jive with the perspective of the person on the first level because of the level he's standing on, that he's not able to accept what the person on the 10th level is telling him. So where you're at in your consciousness, everything appears to be very proper and true. And therefore, it's a great difficulty to actually, even if you find that your opinion is a source of tribulation, usually our opinions are only sources of tribulation because others don't agree with us. It's not that my opinion itself is miserable, it's because people don't see the way I see it, and it's causing me misery because we're not able to gel, we're not able to communicate with each other properly, or there's animosity on account of a different perspective of reality and so on. Otherwise, generally, we think that our understanding of things is pretty good, actually. And even as practicing devotees, we may say, like, okay, I know that this isn't really proper, you know, but, and then you go through the list and you say, actually, I think I'm right. And that way, one naturally struggles. This would be a struggle that probably will continue on until one becomes like really fully Krishna conscious. And he can kind of harmonize various perspectives, you know. A more advanced devotee will be able to harmonize apparent contradictions. Like in the scriptures, one will come across things that appear to contradict, itself. All the shastras contradicting. But an advanced soul can see how they're not contradicting, how they're actually harmonizing points, or points that are glorifying the Supreme Lord from different angle of vision and so on. So that's something that would always be a struggle for the most part, because according to your adhikar, your perspective of reality makes perfect sense. So unless a person has developed faith and proper authority, by which that authority can tell him that it's not like this, or there's something more that you're missing. If he doesn't have that faith in the authority, then he won't be able to really get over that anartha until he becomes a little bit more advanced. Advancement that can happen when you avail yourself to properly situated authorities as well. One needs an authority to be able to kind of crush one's own perspective of things, or if not crush it, broaden one's perspective of reality. And if one has no faith in authority, then I don't know how one would actually get out of that particular dilemma. Faith and authority would be required. When I say authority, I mean authority, spiritual authority. One who is Krishna conscious, like that.
And that authority will allow you to stretch your opinion beyond what you're thinking, but perhaps accept another higher opinion.
Yeah, faith and authority will either correct your misunderstanding, crush it, or just like Arjuna has a certain perspective of reality that he was really attached to. And when Krishna gave him a little bit of chastisement in the beginning, Arjuna was like, no, you're not understanding me, let me explain again. And then finally he realized that he was bewildered and that his opinion, using that language, was actually becoming a source of his bewilderment and misery, which he deliberately expresses to Krishna. So then he avails himself to the opinion or authority of Krishna in order to broaden his perspective of the reality going on, as a play of Bhagavad Gita is concerned, like that. So yes, authority can help us correct our understandings, broaden our understandings, harmonize them, or sometimes they may affirm them also. No, this is proper understanding, like that. In any case, authorities are required for spiritual advancement. That's like the simple.
Hare Krishna. Following up on this point, seeking clarification. As an individual, my responsibility is to be receptive to the feedback of my authorities as they attempt to clear out misconception. And then in terms of others, I can be confident that the Chaitya Guru is the supreme authority and he's taking care of the everyone else's false ego. Is that appropriate?
Can you explain that as far as others are concerned? Again, the Chaitya Guru, and I didn't get that. What do you mean by that?
Like, Himanshu Prabhu's sharing the situation wherein one is feeling distress because of his particular opinion. So that opinion must not correspond perfectly with reality. Therefore, it's giving some distress. So then, in order to be cured of whatever misperception is there, one has certain authorities which are deputed by Krishna to assist one in his spiritual development.
So that's for, that was the first part of your... That's
correct, yeah.
I'm asking about the second part.
So in the second part, there may be persons in my environment who have certain opinions, but it's not my responsibility to evaluate those opinions and like assign some degree of illusion. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 3, explaining the, I think the word Krishna uses, tattva-vid. One who understands the tattva. Anyway, Krishna says, don't disturb the mind of the ignorant who are attached to fruitive activities by trying to say what they're doing is useless, and therefore you should take to Buddha Yoga or devotional service, as Prabhupada has translated. So the idea of this verse, it is expressed nicely by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that there are persons with awakened intelligence, this is the language used by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and persons with sleeping intelligence. So the persons with sleeping intelligence means basically the materialistic jiva, all the way up to the brahmana, all the way up to the brahmana who's identifying himself as a brahmana, as a material body, and so on. They're all counted as those with sleeping intelligence. So they may not be able to understand those with awakened intelligence who may not do certain activities founded within Varnashram Dharma or seem to be doing things or seems to be negligent of the proper principles of religion on account of following a higher principle of religion, namely just devotion to Krishna. So those with sleeping intelligence, they don't appreciate those persons. So Krishna speaking with those with the awakened intelligence, they understand where those persons are coming from, where they have a certain type of adhikar, and therefore they are having a certain sort of understanding of reality, and perhaps understanding that's also yielding in their hearts some animosity toward them. But they don't disturb their minds because they're properly situated where they're at. They're gradually making progress on the path that, the Bahu Nam Jamananante path, the path that will take many lifetimes to perfect. But they're making progress on that path, so we're not going to disturb their minds by, argumentation, which will go on forever. Rather, we'll stay focused on our objective of pleasing Krishna, although it's misunderstood by others. So anyway, the idea here is that everyone does act according to their adhikar. One may assign to themselves a higher level of adhikar than they're actually situated. But the reality is that whatever adhikar you're at, that's what you're going to naturally act upon, especially in various troubling situations. So those who are more advanced devotees, they can kind of make out where people are situated in their consciousness, in their adhikar, as such. And therefore, they really see no contradiction in anything, as such, in one sense. So the materialist is propagating a materialistic program, and he can see, from his understanding of reality, his perspective makes perfect sense. And he might not go up to that person and just start challenging him, for example, seeing that he's attached to such understanding of reality. Of course, when you're dealing with straight materialistic jivas who aren't on a progressive path of spiritual life, a devotee may try to interject, try to inspire proper faith and understanding where he is empowered to do so. But as a general principle, especially in terms of ourselves, it is definitely wise to, especially living in the community of the devotees, to understand that there are various perspectives that come up because people are variously situated in Krishna consciousness. They have various adhikars, and therefore their vision of reality perfectly corresponds with their adhikar. And it may not be wise to go up and just challenge or argue or even spend your time contemplating how they're wrong, and because that's obviously not spiritually progressive. And the discussion like this one or a smaller discussion where devotees are talking about the tattvas of Krishna consciousness, one can bring those discussions, those opinions can be brought to the table for discussion and clarification. As Kaviraj Goswami says, one should not be lazy in discussing the Siddhanta. So it could be a fact that people have actually wrong perspectives or perspectives that need to be brought in, including ourselves. And therefore, it is nice to have discussions such as this one. Usually smaller is more effective, where those opinions, as what the word is being used, can be brought to the table and discussed on the strength of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra for everyone's clarification, elevation, and so on. And then as far as our personal practice is concerned, as we're moving about in the day, as I was mentioning in another class, it's not like it is our responsibility to go up and size up everyone, size up what is their opinion, how that opinion is wrong. Nor is that very uplifting or inspiring or Krishna conscious. We just focus on developing and clarifying our own conceptions, and then when we're empowered, we can have an impact.
I was just thinking of when Mother Premadrugni gave her presentation on the forest fire in Krishna Lila, which is representative of internal turmoil in the community of devotees. She explained that for beginning devotees, then they will fault their fellow devotees on the basis of external practices. Oh, you're only chanting four rounds. You're not so serious. You know, why are you wasting my time? You come back when you're chanting eight rounds or whatever. And then intermediate level devotees, they will fault others, like you're saying, on the level of this philosophical understanding because of differences in adhikar. I just was appreciating it. To me, it seems that the way that a person who's on the highest level of devotional service, he's able to discuss these topics and entertain other people's philosophical opinion and perhaps even present his own, but there's never any animosity. There's never any sense of like separateness, you know, us and them mentality. Because he doesn't have this, what's it called, like proprietorship over his own.
I would use the word ass-like mentality, because what you're quoting from is actually coming from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Jaiva Dharma.
Yeah.
Where he says there are two types of personalities, ass-like and swan-like. And he says amongst the neophyte devotees and the Madhyam Adhikaris, there are both types of persons, ass-like persons and swan-like persons. So with neophytes, he mentions that they will criticize one another for external things primarily, external practices and so on. The ass-like devotees spend their consciousness absorbed in those things. They're not doing this, they're not dressed like this, they don't look like that, etc. Those are the ass-like neophyte devotees. And the swan-like neophyte devotees, they don't concern themselves with those externals, sizing people up based on externals. They themselves try to just get a higher level of adhikar, try to make spiritual progress. In other words, that they may also notice those things, and perhaps even it kind of causes some change in the mental state, but they will focus on themselves trying to become more progressive in their own consciousness. Amongst the Madhyam Adhikaris, there are two types, ass-like and swan-like, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. And yes, it's usually on the area of philosophical discussion that the ass-like Madhyam Adhikaris will absorb themselves in the faults of others and their philosophical misconceptions and so on. And the swan-like Madhyam Adhikaris will recognize that there are various opinions, but they themselves are not fully Krishna conscious, so they will focus mostly, primarily, on just developing their own Krishna consciousness more. And yes, amongst swan-like individuals, there could be discussion without animosity. Because they're swan-like, they can take the swan-like meaning they can take the essences of things without getting bogged down on various detailed points and so on. Otherwise, their main thing is that they will recognize that there will be discrepancies and differences and so on, but they will focus on themselves becoming fully Krishna conscious, recognizing that they're not fully Krishna conscious, and that simply arguing about who's got the right philosophical point isn't going to help them become more Krishna conscious. Rather, they need to clarify their own understanding, apply it, and then taste the fruit for themselves. And then they may be empowered to help others to do so. So amongst Madhyamas and neophyte devotees, there are both types of persons, ass-like and swan-like. She was quoting all the acharyas there, so I remember that particular section.
I'd wanted to say that, I wanted to pose this question. Could we say that the feature of the swan-like devotee is that the feature that allows him to not fault others is that he doesn't claim proprietorship over, or let's say, doership. He doesn't take that position of feeling himself the doer in terms of making like advancement.
Because one could probably say that, arguably. And the way Bhajan Thakur presents it, the swan-like persons are, they're focused on their goal of life. That's kind of the element that's underscored in his discussion in that section. And so I think in accord with that focus, then these other elements will be there as well. He's not trying to lord it over others. He's not trying to claim proprietorship. I'm going to arguably all those good qualities will come up because his focus is very eka. Vyavasayatmika buddhi ekaha kuru nandana. He's very focused on becoming actually Krishna conscious. Where many of us are not actually Krishna conscious. Krishna consciousness is just a ideal for all of us. A high ideal, but one that we have yet to achieve. And so the swan-like individuals are focused on actually achieving that ideal. So they don't have time for pettiness. They don't have time for lording over others, trying to control the situation, trying to defeat others and their various misunderstandings. They don't even have time to discuss how someone's got animosity toward them. It's like, this person hates you. Wow, that's intense. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. And it's time to make, where is the time for all of this, these sorts of things? They're kind of quite intensely focused. At least that's what it seems that Bhaktivinoda Thakur underscores in his discussion of the aspects of like persons. I remember I was having some, there was some animosity between myself and another devotee, and we were back and forth, emails were going boom, 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 like 2-3 times. Finally, I wrote one email. I said, Prabhu, life is too short for all this. All this, it takes hours to write even an email like that. You have to respond to everyone's critiques of you and all the various things that you've done wrong and that you're a bad person, this, that. It's taking up too much life, life that is meant to be given to Krishna. So I think along with that type of focus, these other good qualities definitely manifest themselves.
Yeah, I guess I have a question just on based on what you were just saying. Maybe Yaya, you wanted to say something on this topic or a different topic?
I guess since I'm really...
I was just wondering, like in the case that one were to find out a certain devotee has an excessive degree of animosity towards him, as you're saying, perhaps one reaction would be just kind of neutrality. But it seems like personally, I would feel somewhat disturbed and would be inclined to like seek understanding, you know, perhaps even like apologizing for whatever I had done that had caused such intense emotion.
For this sort of discussion, you have to clarify context. Because, for example, RGBCs have a lot of negative energy coming from them from a lot of different places, within our movement, outside our movement. If they had to spend their time clarifying their situation to every single individual jiva who's got problems with them, they wouldn't have any time for their service. So I think with that sort of statement, you would have to clarify context. In a certain context, yeah, you may take the time out. Okay, this I need to address this situation, and this isn't good. In another context, you may say this person is stubborn. He will never change his opinion about so and so and so, and therefore there is no need to really address that particular issue. Although you have some issue with me, there is no reason. Just like some persons who write these magazines against a lot of our devotees, there's no use in going over there and having a conversation with them. They're already stuck on their point that anyone but Prabhupada, for example, is fallen, and therefore they have no right to be guru in this, that. They're not going to change their opinion just because you wouldn't have a conversation with them. And the animosity will continue. So with something like that, context would have to be given. So in certain contexts, it may apply. In a lot, it may not apply. Life is short. That's on the...
Hare Krishna. So this goes back to your old days of Krishna consciousness, since we're bringing up the topic of opinion. So like, suppose somebody's opinion is correct, because I remember the story of you and Revati Nanda. I think you mentioned something about something from Bhagavad Gita, and it was the right understanding. You were basically directly quoting Prabhupada, and he said, this is not the right understanding. So you said at the time, your opinion was that I didn't respond to that because I knew he would say, he's teaching me a higher principle, whatever it is, humility or whatever. So in retrospect, do you think your response was correct? I mean, I suspect it was. Otherwise, he'll blast you even more.
One time, he's referring, Revati Nanda Prabhu was a devotee that trained me. So one time we were in the room, he and I, one other person, and this person was asking me a question from Bhagavad Gita. So I was giving him an answer that I had just read from Prabhupada's purport. And so it was like the correct understanding. So when I was explaining it to this devotee, right about to now chastising me, he said, "You got it wrong." You know, he just blasted me, "You got it wrong." And I was like, "No, this is what Prabhupada says in his purport." And he said, "No, he doesn't." And then he began to explain it in the wrong way. At least as far as Prabhupada's purport was concerned. But I was scared to say anything because I was like, if I say something, if I was like, "Prabhupada, I'll just show you. Prabhupada says it." To a higher principle. Instead of go through the tribulation of getting chastised further, I just kept my mouth shut. And took the humble position externally. In my mind, I was like, "He's wrong. He doesn't know what he's talking about." And after we leave this room, I'm going to properly ask devotee when Ray Bhatsinandapur isn't around, you know. That's what was going on internally, in all honesty. But externally, I took the humble approach. I can't honestly say that my consciousness was so elevated to think in that way fully. And let him he chastised me for like 10 minutes on that. That I'm mental speculating, and it's not proper to mental speculate and so on. I was just like, I didn't say anything. But yes, in a certain principle, I remember another case where a devotee did do something that was correct, and a senior devotee chastised him for it. And so this devotee came to the senior devotee and kind of complained, you know, "Why did you chastise me for this? This is actually the proper place," and so on. And the senior devotee told him that, "I knew that actually. I was just saying, if you were, how would you respond to that situation?" So whether that was right or wrong, various opinions may be there. But I did learn something from that, that you're not always right just because you're right, technically speaking. You may be right, technically speaking, but wrong in terms of the grand scheme of things. Like, for example, you challenge a senior devotee in an open arena on some philosophical point. You challenge him, you try to embarrass him in front of everyone and so on. So technically speaking, you might be right on that philosophical point. But in the grand scheme of things, you're about to go down in your Christian consciousness on account of committing an offense. So then more advanced devotees will be able to weigh these sorts of things. Just like another example from the Shastras is in the case of, there's several examples. I'm thinking of Devananda Pandit, where he was a great orator of the Bhagavatam. He had many disciples. One time, Srivas Pandit came to his assembly, and Srivas is absorbed in prema. So he begins hearing this Bhagavad Katha coming from also Devananda Pandit, who wasn't a pure devotee at the time. And he begins crying. Now, normally that's not something you should do in the class, especially in an open class. I mean, someone's giving Bhagavatam class and you just bust out into ecstatic rapture. And for us, it won't be ecstatic rapture. It's just like you're trying to get attention. So then it was kind of taken in that way. So the disciples of Devananda Pandit just, you know, try to get him out of his state of stupor, but he was actually absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So they just picked him up and threw him outside. And then when Srivas came out of his ecstatic trance, he was very disappointed that he was treated in that way for relishing Krishna consciousness, and he left. Several years later, this happened, I think, before Lord Chaitanya was born. Several years later, Lord Chaitanya was being very negligent of Devananda Pandit. Anyway, fast forward the story, he later on goes to Devananda Pandit and tells him because of this offense that you committed to Srivas Pandit. So anyway, the point I'm making is that technically, he may have been right. You shouldn't have outbursts of tears in the middle of a Bhagavatam class. It's quite distracting, as you can imagine. But in the grand scheme of things, he was wrong. He went down. So a devotee is one who's very aware. He's very conscious of all these sort of factors that come into play. When neophyte devotees, when we learn, when we gain some knowledge, we usually become, we gain in one way and we lose broader perspective, or we don't have broader perspective. So then we say, this is the right point, and there can be no other right point. This is the full understanding. And that way we tend to make many offenses. An example I often like to give is with the nectar devotion, when you learn all those rules in the beginning. So then a person who follows these rules, those are persons who are properly situated in Krishna consciousness. So I often mention this many times. One time, one of the rules is that you should not pass air from the deities. You understand? You shouldn't fart in front of the deities in the temple room. So that's a rule that comes up in this section. So I had the understanding then. So you look for these sorts of things, you know. People shouldn't fart. People shouldn't offer obeisances on one hand. People should keep their feet covered when they sit down. These are the things I used to look for in the beginning. And that's right, because that's what it says in the books. So then I often mention this. My world was blown away when one time one very senior Prabhupada disciple, who joined in the 60s, he was visiting Chicago. And during japa time, me and Raybhat Nanda Prabhu were sitting in the back in between these doors here. And the sannyasi was just sitting in front of us, and we were all chanting japa. Then all of a sudden, the sannyasi just like lifted up. And he let it rip. It was like loud. It wasn't even like he was trying to hide. He just like lifted up. Very loud. And Raybhat Nanda Prabhu and I were like, we were, The curtains are, it's a temple room though, and it's like a sacred space. So when he did, me and Raybhat Nanda was, I can't believe he did. And then we went upstairs and we started having like an hour long discussion about, you know, is he properly situated? Because he passed air like that. I mean, he didn't even care it was a temple room and other devotees that could be disturbing to our minds. Maybe the smell would come in and make our japa defocused. And he didn't consider all these points. You know, like this, we were discussing and analyzing the situation. And so in that way, we started making an offense. You know, you start making, committing an aparadha, actually, moving into that area at least. So you become so stuck on one point which seems to be right, but in the greater scheme of things, you end up becoming wrong. And so a devotee is one who is deeply thoughtful. You know, Manishina, I think is the word used often. He's a very deeply thoughtful person. And so, and therefore you can find that amongst asks like neophytes or madhyamadikaris, when they can't see eye to eye, a more advanced devotee can actually harmonize because he's more deeply thoughtful than a lot of these individuals. And they're able to harmonize apparent contradictions and so on. So, yeah, that depth is, of course, something that we're aspiring for, but something that's required. I may have been right technically speaking, but I would have been wrong if I challenged Raybhat like that. I would have lost out on the chance to at least evolve my own humility. Even if it was just external, it's a start. Even external actions of humility count for something, just like offering obeisances to the deity. It's not like we're really surrendered to the Lord when we offer our obeisances. We just do it because it's part of the ritual, and yet it's still a very important action to do. It counts for something. Even if done without devotion, it has great benefit. And so in that way, you know, I could say I gained a little bit. In fact, later on, I gained a lot actually, because I remember later on, this is right before Raybhat Nanda Prabhu left Chicago to leave his body. He thanked me actually one time. He said, you know, you're such a good person to try to teach in Krishna consciousness because you never talked back to me. And then he himself honestly admitted that sometimes I was overly harsh with you and challenged, you know, very kind of harsh. And he said, but you never talked back, you never challenged. And actually, the time that this happened, it was that there was this other devotee that he was really attached to also, who was a little bit younger than me. So he was trying to train this devotee in Krishna consciousness, but this devotee used to always talk back to him. And so finally he was like, forget it, get out of here, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And then he came to me and was like, you know, you never talk back, you always... So in that way, I felt that I gained a lot. Even though internally I wasn't perfectly situated, obviously, but I gained, even though I may have been technically right on a certain external point. It's a philosophical, but it's still external. I gained in a lot of other ways. I wasn't deeply thoughtful. I was just lucky that I kept my mouth shutting and gained. But we don't want to just be lucky. We want to be thoughtful and gain by our thoughtfulness and not just by our luck or an inconversant step in the right direction. Okay. You want to have this final thing?
Thank you. This reminds me, I think, one class you mentioned a long time ago where Bhaktisiddhanta mentioned that even if the pure devotee misquotes like the very verse, or yeah. I'm not sure you might know it. So
it's in the essay that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta wrote called Thakur Bhakti Vinod. And he says, even if the pure devotee misquotes, he's right. And even if the non-devotee quotes properly, he's wrong. On the devotion or lack thereof. That's in the essay called Thakur Bhakti Vinod. That's a very nice essay. So we'll finish here because it's 8:30. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.